This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Inside Story on BFM 89.9.
Good evening. This is Inside Story with Sharmila Ganesan and Lee Chui Lin. Tonight, we're focusing on the Anti-Sexual Harassment Bill, specifically the amendments that women's groups are calling for.
First, we're going to hear from the Joint Action Group for Gender Equality on what they'd like to see, and then the larger importance of making stakeholders a key part of the process when working on bills like these.
Tell us, what would you like to see in the Anti-Sexual Harassment Bill? You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. This is Inside Story. It is 6:08, and truly, this Anti-Sexual Harassment Bill has taken a long journey to get here, right? Like, it's been in the works since the 1990s. And finally, the first reading of the bill took place on the 15th of December last year. The second reading took place yesterday. But women's groups are pointing out, and I believe the phrase they're using is that it's not quite there yet. And because of that, they've actually pointed out a number of gaps, and they're calling for an amendment to the bill before it's passed.
Okay, so some details there, right? The women's groups in question include the Joint Action Group for Gender Equality and Gender Consultancy and Young Women Making Change. And they released a press statement talking about this very thing. And so they are calling for effective victim-centric legislation. And some of the gaps that they've identified include a limited definition of sexual harassment, which fails to cover harassment that takes place in a public or group setting. For example, a supervisor making sexual innuendos to subordinates within a workplace. The bill also doesn't account for the lack of laws covering sexual harassment in schools, universities, public transport, malls, other settings, and the Employment Act doesn't sufficiently address the issue in the workplace. The bill also fails to protect complainants against victimization, where they're ill-treated or face negative consequences for making said complaints. So overall, I think some very important points being brought up, especially ones that are more contextual and true to life.
So they are calling for a number of things, right? One is to amend the existing proposal. They're also calling for additions of other things to strengthen the bill as it is. We are going to be speaking, of course, to a representative of JAG later. But just a run through of some of the main things they're highlighting, or rather proposing be amended. To carry on from what you said, Lynn, they want a provision on victimization so as to protect complainants. They also want the inclusion of organizational duties to prevent and address sexual harassment, which includes things like appointing organization administrators or even explicitly prohibiting sexual harassment, which, you know, it surprisingly is missing from the bill, mandating basic training on sexual harassment, having a clear complaints mechanism. They also talked about extending the definition of sexual harassment to include an environment that is hostile or offensive or intimidating. Other amendments include suggestions for a more diverse composition for a tribunal so that it adequately represents the Malaysian population. So there are a lot of things here to really talk about, right? Because it's one thing to have a bill, but the bill should actually serve the purpose that it's intended to, rather than to be so general as to not really address the issues, the way these issues actually translate to in the ground.
Yes, on the ground is an important point, because when I was looking through this and thinking about it, I'm surprised that the amendments weren't there, you know, mostly because if you've ever, read up on the issue or, you know, talked about it, there is a recognition that these are things that should be put in place, particularly that point about creating a hostile, offensive or intimidating environment. This is something that is actually part of the literature, so to speak, when talking or thinking about this. But the other thing that this highlights is that point about the diverse composition of tribunal members speaks to, I think, recognizing the crucial nature of including the people who need to be included, whether it's on a tribunal point of view, whether it is in terms of the drafting and the collaboration, because something like this is deeply specific, right? We've talked about this many times over, and talking to people who are actually have been affected, may be affected, and who therefore have a more intimate, even if they don't want to have that understanding, is going to be key in drafting a bill that, like you say, is actually effective.
And it does call into question, because we have heard throughout this process that they are consulting with women's groups, that they are consulting with activists. So why was this not made a part of the draft in the first place, right? So we're going to basically discuss this from two aspects. After this, we're going to hear from Janelle Tan, who is here representing the Joint Action Group for Gender Equality. But we will also discuss the importance of including stakeholders in the conversation, in the drafting process. We'd like to hear from you. What would you like to see in the anti-sexual harassment bill? You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio.
Beyond frivolous matters, BFM 89.9, the business station.
It is 6:14. You're listening to Inside Story with Sharmila and Lynn. And today we're discussing calls from women's groups for amendments to the proposed anti-sexual harassment bill. It is being tabled during this session of parliament. So, they're saying that it's just not doing enough. We'd like to hear from you. What would you like to see in this bill? You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. Joining us now is Janelle Tan, who is Information and Communications Officer of AWAM, which is part of the Joint Action Group for Gender Equality. Janelle, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me again.
So let's start off with the concerns that JAG has about the bill. What amendments would you like to see?
So if I were to put it in just one sentence, right, JAG's concerns with regards to the anti-sexual harassment bill is that as much as we appreciate important provisions like the establishment of a tribunal, but due to certain provisions that are lacking, it is still not victim-centric and comprehensive enough. So I'll just go very briefly into the proposed additions or amendments that we'd like to see. The most important provisions that we are campaigning for is to re-include provisions related to, one, the prohibition of sexual harassment, two, the prohibition of assisting sexual harassment, because sexual harassment is not necessarily just perpetrated by the perpetrator against the survivor. It can also be a result of assistance or encouragement by other people. So that's very important. The third one is to re-include provisions related to organizational duties to prevent and address sexual harassment. I mean, we've seen enough of this in terms of, the period spot checks and the sexual harassment incidents that have been happening in our schools last year and over the years. So that alone would be enough to give an indication of just how important it is to get institutions on board to come up with, for example, sexual harassment policies, proper grievance procedures that would allow survivors to come forward and report. So we need organizations to take their responsibility to prevent sexual harassment in their spaces. So that's the third one. The fourth one is victimization. So, we see this generally across gender-based violence, no matter what. So when survivors come forward to report, they typically experience victimization as a retaliatory response. So when you have this provision in law that, that has zero tolerance against victimization, then it'll be more effective in helping survivors seek for redress. Another very important thing that I would like to stress here is to expand on the definition of sexual harassment. If you were to go to the Parliament's website and look at the current definition that's within the legislation, right, you will notice the phrase directed at a person for sexual harassment. As we know, in the case of, for example, Ayn's case, Ayn was not the direct recipient of the rape joke. She was sexually harassed somehow because she felt that the joke was offensive and it was degrading. So as you can see, sexual harassment occurred not because it was directed at her, but somehow it just occurred as a result of, the incident. So that has to be amended. There's also a need to include this phrase of the creation of an intimidating, offensive, et cetera, environment, because sexual harassment, one, it has taken place in a specific space. It can make the whole environment hostile, not just for survivors, but also for bystanders as well. So that's important to be included in the definition. That's all in short.
So what are the potential challenges actually in pushing these amendments through?
Well, one thing is, there's still a lot of progress that needs to be made in terms of addressing the lack of awareness of sexual harassment. By that, I don't just mean, what it is. It's also very important to make sure that people take sexual harassment seriously, like properly seriously. Once you do, then the elements of everyone playing a role in addressing and preventing sexual harassment, well, that once you truly take it seriously, then people will not, including legislators and even policymakers, they will not have much qualms in terms of accepting or enshrining in law the need, for example, for organizational responsibility to address and prevent sexual harassment. That's, I think, a key challenge in pushing these amendments through. For example, like, I think over the last couple of years or so, we've seen resistance from, for example, the Malaysian Employers Federation law, and they came up with justification that, oh, we have adequate laws already to address, you know, in the Employment Act 1955, in the Penal Code, and etc. But then again, of course, that's not a reflection of reality, because sexual harassment is still prevalent in spaces like workplaces. Survivors still find it difficult to come forward. So that's a hurdle that we need to go through.
So how much consultation has there actually been with stakeholders on the drafting of this bill?
Generally, from what I know, it started as early as 2001. Of course, on and off, but I think somewhere from 2001, 2012, there have been consultations back and forth between the women's groups and the Ministry of Women and also other stakeholders in terms of the bill. So there have been multiple revisions of the draft ever since it was first conceptualized in the 1990s. And then I would say there's a more extensive consultation process, even starting from 2017 until around 2020. If I'm not mistaken, a revised draft was requested by the Ministry of Women in 2017. And that eventually kickstarted also this formation of the whole special task force, consisting of various CSO representatives and also other stakeholders who engaged with the Ministry of Women to come up with a comprehensive bill in 2019, 2020. So consultations have basically been on the way for the last three decades.
Okay, so considering then that there has been that consultation and outreach, why the gaps in the draft?
To be very honest, I mean, just to be very frank, like the provisions related to prohibition of sexual harassment, victimization, assisting sexual harassment, even organizing duty of care. From what I know, these provisions were already even in the draft that was proposed by the Special Project Task Force. As to the exact reasons why they were omitted after having scrutinized by the AGC, to be honest, I don't know. But I think it's highly likely with regards to, especially, for example, the organization duty of care. I think I can postulate that perhaps the possible reason for exclusion of those provisions, for example, maybe because they've encountered resistance from certain quarters, for example, from employers, like or rather related stakeholders like the MEF, the Malaysian Employers Federation. So I'm just postulating that that may be a very big reason why. But as for the rest, I'm not entirely sure. Nevertheless, it is within our greatest interest and also in public interest to advocate for the re-inclusion of these provisions, because it is only by re-including these provisions then this legislation can be very effective in not just addressing but also preventing sexual harassment.
So have members of JAG been reaching out to lawmakers to discuss this?
For specific details, I'm honestly not sure. That may most likely have taken place over the last, over the last couple of decades, you know, because from what I understand, women's groups have consulted with many different stakeholders. But the one that I'm aware of was back in 2020, whereby my colleagues in Awam, they actually went to Parliament to engage with MPs across both sides of the political divide to make them aware about this whole anti-sexual harassment bill and why it should be passed. So that took place in 2020, and there was bipartisan support. And as you can see on social media accounts, by MPs on both sides in passing an anti-sexual harassment bill. So now the most important thing is to make sure that there's buy-in. It's not just about passing the bill anymore. Rather, it's to make sure that the anti-sexual harassment bill is comprehensive and it's truly victim-centric. So the buy-in from MPs on both sides on this is very crucial.
So is there then enough political will to not just pass the bill, right, which is the end point, but to actually make the needed amendments that you're pushing for?
In 2020, as I said earlier, there has been bipartisan support in passing the bill. As we engage with individual MPs as much as possible on both sides, even up till now, for those we have engaged with, whether it's Awam individually or, you know, with other women's groups as a whole, so far there has been support. Now it's just primarily a matter of pushing the right buttons to pressure the relevant stakeholders to take into consideration amendments, especially the Ministry of Women, and to a greater extent, I think the AGC. I think these are the two primary stakeholders that we really, really want to go all the way up and pressure to pass amendments. But so far, yes, by the legislators on both sides, for those whom we've specifically engaged with, yes, there has been support, but more work needs to be done.
What happens if the bill isn't amended? What do you plan to do?
Well, to be honest, the passing the bill itself is important because it is a very, very, it is a sign to the public, and it does, you know, significantly raise public awareness in terms of, you know, like sexual harassment is not tolerated, et cetera, et cetera. But the repercussion of this is it would be a very time-consuming process because when you pass a bill, once it's, you know, one becomes an act, some time needs to be passed to monitor its implementation, and you also need to, you know, there that sometime we have lapse until certain gaps just come into play, and then that will trigger, you know, like conversations on amendments and stuff. So this whole process would be very time-consuming. The repercussion, of course, is ultimately down to the rakyat themselves because we are the ones who will be, I mean, women especially and girls will be the ones being sexually harassed in all spaces. So even if the bill amended is amended, that's great because we have the tribunal and all. But with the current gaps involved, it may not be as effective. It may not be as effective alone in covering the gaps that we already see in existing laws, not to mention the other very important element of preventing sexual harassment, because after all, it's not just about addressing, it's also about bringing down the number of sexual harassment cases across all sectors in the long run. So that's the repercussion that we're very much hoping to avoid at all costs. And so, yes, the focus by all of us in the coalition, not just JAG, but also and Gender Consultancy and Young Women Making Change, is to see these amendments through so that we won't need to undergo the very protracted process that we have seen, for example, for the Domestic Violence Act 1994. I mean, the inclusion of the definition of psychological abuse for Domestic Violence Act only came in 2012, which was around 8 years after 1994. So we want to see this repeat itself for sexual harassment? I don't think so. So as much as we will plan for, you know, like let's say if this does not go through and we have to plan again, yes, but our ultimate priority remains within trying our best to see these amendments through.
Janelle, thanks for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much.
That was Janelle Tan, Information and Communications Officer of AWAM, speaking to us about proposed amendments that they are calling for to the Anti-Sexual Harassment Bill, which is going to be tabled in this session of Parliament. Let us know, what would you like to see in this bill? You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. After this, we'll be speaking with Maha Balakrishnan, parliamentary consultant and researcher, on the importance of engaging with stakeholders when it comes to the drafting of bills. So let us know what you think. That number to call again, 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio, and keep it here on Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
Brainy, fancy material. BFM 89.9.
This is Inside Story with Sharmila and Lynn. And we speaking about the Anti-Sexual Harassment Bill that is going to be tabled in this session of Parliament, specifically about criticism from women's rights groups that the bill doesn't cover enough. And so we've been asking you for your thoughts. What would you like to see in the bill? You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. We will be joined very shortly by Maha Balakrishnan, who is a parliamentary consultant and researcher, to discuss the importance of including stakeholders in the drafting process. But before that, I think we have time for some messages.
So let's see. Let's start with this from Violet, who says, you know, sexual harassment ranges from unwanted touching, gesturing, inappropriate jokes from those around you who sometimes can be your seniors. Though I'm glad that an anti-sexual harassment bill is being tabled, it still hasn't quite hit the mark yet. And that's certainly, I think, something that we heard earlier from Janelle, right? But the other part of it is who sometimes can be your seniors. And that goes to the importance of creating and protecting against the creating of a hostile environment. And I think it's worth also considering that a hostile environment is one in which people don't feel safe to bring up these issues. And so even if you have the mechanism after the fact for everything to be dealt with and so on and so forth, if nobody feels safe reporting it, you're never going to hear anything. Those mechanisms are never going to actually kick into place.
And that's why so much of the focus of the amendments they want to make actually revolves around the environment and not just a particular action, right? Selena says, I had a senior colleague who had rape jokes made to her as if it were nothing. There was no action taken. Just imagine having to work with someone like that all the time. I would have been so uncomfortable.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we've been using this a lot, this example a lot. And I think it's because of Ayn Husniza, right? But it's also because it speaks to the larger culture of it all, about the fact that there is a culture, or we are in a culture in which people feel like it's okay to say this. And if we don't account for this in what is supposed to be a wide-reaching bill, then it's going to be a problem.
Keep those thoughts coming. If you'd like to weigh in, what would you like to see in the anti-sexual harassment bill? You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, we heard from JAG earlier, but of course, the other part of this is really, how do these drafts get made? How can stakeholders be better engaged in that process? And for that, we have joining us today, Maha Balakrishna, who is a parliamentary consultant and a researcher. Maha, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So what is the process of drafting and pushing a bill through in Parliament?
Well, there are several processes. So before a bill arrives in Parliament, of course, it is the policy sub-formulated and crafted by the executive branch. So each ministry will formulate the policies that fall within their purview with aid and assistance from the Attorney General's chambers. And the way in which that process takes place, really, there are some guidelines and there are usually mechanisms that involve consultation that are weaved into it. But it's fairly murky. We can't speak to a very clear process that is followed across different ministries. And a lot actually depends on who heads the ministry and, you know, the top civil servants as well in those ministries and those various departments. But once it gets to Parliament, then the structure is fairly regulated and fairly reflective of Westminster parliaments across the world, with some small but vital differences. So I usually have visual aids when I explain this, because otherwise listeners' eyes tend to glaze over. So I'll try and keep this as simple as possible. So once a bill gets into Parliament, essentially there are four stages. The first is first reading, when the bill gets tabled, and that's a formality. Yeah, no debates take place, no discussions on the bill. Then it moves into second reading. And in the second reading, that is where the policies of the bill get discussed and debated. And then if there is general agreement on how the policies are formulated and what policies are covered in the bill, then the House will pass that bill and goes into the committee stage. This is where it gets a little bit complicated. Yeah, and I'll come back to the committee stage in a minute. But essentially, the purpose of the committee stage is no longer to debate the policy issues, but to look at the specific particulars. Right. So once it comes out of second reading, essentially the policies are agreed. Now you just look at how those policies are translated into words. Right. And you can make amendments at those stages, in that stage. But the amendments are limited to changes to the specific clauses. Yeah. And really, that is essentially the final substantive stage in the process. So once you get through that stage, it goes into the report stage, and then after that, the third reading. And in third reading, really nothing much happens. Yeah, you can only make very small amendments. Now, I just want to come back to the committee stage, because that's really crucial here and really for our purposes as well. Now, the interesting thing about the Westminster process of passing a bill is that parliaments are actually given two chances to move a bill from the floor of the House into a committee. Yeah. Now, of course, the one we know is the committee stage. And in the committee stage, there's two things that can happen. Either the bill stays in the House and the House becomes a committee of the whole, or the House can pass a special motion to move that bill into a select committee. Now, in both cases, in whichever way the committee is formed, those committees are still limited to looking at only the particulars of the bill. They cannot debate the policy. But the key difference, of course, is that if the bill is reviewed by the committee of the whole in the House itself, then, you know, you can't get outside evidence. You can't bring in experts and interested parties to talk to you, take the evidence, listen to them. But if it moves into a select committee, then you can do that. So that's the key difference. And now just a final point if I were to make. So as I said, you can send it to select committee at the committee stage, but there is also this very interesting opportunity to send a bill to a select committee before second reading. So immediately after first reading, and really interestingly enough, that's where we stand at this precise point in time with this anti-sexual harassment bill. What is the benefit of sending the anti-sexual harassment bill into a committee now? Well, it has the same powers as a committee in committee stage, but the committee can look at the policy issues. They can put forward proposals on new policies, on changes to the policies as well. So that's why this moment in time is really crucial for all the stakeholders who are involved in this process.
Let's talk about that, right? About the consultations with stakeholders. Broadly speaking, why does this matter, especially when it comes to bills in general and bills like the one that we're talking about today?
Well, you know, all bills should actually include a mandated consultation process with stakeholders because obviously bills affect our lives, yeah, whether it's from an economic perspective, political or social perspective. So the question really is not why, but how inclusive and participatory should that consultation process be? And when it comes to socioeconomic policies that deal directly with individual rights, then the case for consultation and for wide engagement with society becomes all the more crucial before the new laws are presented even, because obviously of the significant impact that it will have on human rights and fundamental liberties. So in our political system, and again, the traditional Westminster parliamentary system, there is actually already a process that's in place that the government here could have followed, which is to present a white paper beforehand. So if I may just very quickly summarize what a white paper is. So a white paper is essentially a public document that is published by the government, which outlines what their policy proposals are or what their proposed legislation is before it goes into parliament. And then they invite feedback. So there is a process then now where everyone can look at the actual policy or bill that the government wants to propose before it goes into parliament and give feedback. So that's really crucial. And in my opinion, that's definitely what ought to have been done with this bill.
Now, for people and organizations who would like to weigh in, how can they ensure that they are part of this conversation and actually have a seat at the table?
Well, really by speaking up, speaking loudly and also speaking frequently. And that is, I think, because unfortunately at this point in time, our parliament is a fairly closed institution. And by that, I mean that there are actually very few entry points for non-government actors to demand the chance to be heard on any policy issue. Yeah. So any entry point into parliament now requires an invitation. So for example, if you want to appear before a committee, you have no right to appear before a committee. You need to be invited, right? Even something like wanting to put forward a parliamentary question, you don't have a right to put forward a parliamentary question. You have to really rely on an MP to sponsor your question. Right. So because of that, there are very limited options. So this is actually in stark contrast to other Westminster systems, like in the UK and so on, where engagement has over time become either part of the rules or part of the convention. So there is automatic engagement with the public, with committee proceedings, particularly, and even in terms of other procedures, you know, parliamentary petitions, etc., give the members of the public and stakeholders direct access to parliamentary process. It gives them the ability to force debates on the floor of the House. So that's crucial. So because we don't have those options, what people who are interested in participating can do is to really, first of all, sell their case and make their case with the public, yeah, build traction. And then, of course, start engaging MPs outside the parliamentary process. So there's no reason why you can't reach out to MPs now and speak to them or request to meet with them. And that can hopefully lead to them inviting you into parliament to participate in the process.
We're talking about the Anti-Sexual Harassment Bill, specifically the fact that women's groups are calling for amendments to it. And we're speaking with parliamentary consultant and researcher Maha Balakrishnan. We'll continue our conversation after this, but do weigh in. What would you like to see in the bill? You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio.
Break from monotony. BFM 89.9.
It is 6:52. You're listening to Inside Story with Sharmila and Lynn, and we're discussing proposed amendments to the Anti-Sexual Harassment Bill. And specifically, we're now discussing how to engage stakeholders in the drafting process. Let us know, what would you like to see in this bill? You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. We're continuing our conversation with parliamentary consultant and researcher Maha Balakrishnan. Maha, so in the past, how often have we seen interest groups consulted when it comes to new bills?
Yeah, not so often. Unfortunately, as I said earlier, it's not a practice of our Dewan Rakyat to do this. There are a number of really, I think, interesting examples. So in the most recent past, of course, we have the IPCMC bill that was tabled at the tail end of 2019 that was sent into a select committee. And because it was sent to a select committee, the inquiry that was conducted was quite comprehensive and very inclusive. That committee engaged a wide range of both government and not government actors. And they came up with a fairly, I would say, rigorous report and set of recommendations. However, what happened after was that there just wasn't enough political will, I think, to see the proposals across the finish line. And so the bill was ultimately pulled when it went back to the House. So that's unfortunate. But then if you look at 2017, the amendments to the Domestic Violence Act, for example, that also was fairly consultative, the process. And if we go back a little further, all the way back to 2004, when there was this a whole raft of amendments that was proposed to the criminal laws in this country, you know, the Penal Code and the Criminal Procedure Code. And the government then set up a select committee before second reading that could therefore look at the policy issues. And they too conducted a fairly comprehensive inquiry process and fairly consultative process. However, they took 2 years. But, you know, ultimately, I think that there was general acceptance of most of the recommendations from that committee. So really a mixed bag. I would say that that has been a mixed bag.
We spoke about this earlier with our guests from Awam, but part of the feedback related to the Anti-Sexual Harassment Bill has been about its language and the context of the language. How important is language and specificity when it comes to bills?
Well, language and the meaning of words and phrases is actually at the heart of any piece of legislation. I mean, many a lawyer has made a fortune from ambiguities in the wording of laws. So really, a lot can turn on the meaning of a word, but also whether certain words are included or excluded. And I think coming back to, you know, what Janelle was talking to you about. So let's look at some of the examples that she talked about, right? That they want the bill to now also cover the prevention of sexual harassment, not just to set up mechanisms to deal with harassment after the fact. So the wording to insert that, insert a provision on prevention is fairly simple. But the effect of it is to confer power on the executive agencies to be able to take action, you know, whether it is to produce subsidiary regulations or guidelines or code or codes of conduct that would bind individuals as well as organizations, yeah, to improve their workplaces and also public spaces. So really, words and the specificity of words are very important. And again, similarly with the proposed amendments to include the prohibition against creating an intimidating, offensive or hostile work environment, right? Again, the impact of doing that will be extraordinary, right? So without that, what we are left with is really an act that some people, some very clever lawyers could argue only makes not so much an offense, but that only makes illegal, if you will, direct sexual harassment. And as most of us know, yeah, oftentimes harassment isn't direct. Oftentimes harassment comes from the creation of that hostile environment that Janelle was talking about.
So we have about a couple of minutes left. What else can be done to demand better accountability and transparency when it comes to tabling and drafting bills?
You know, I think if we're talking about just from a system perspective on how to improve the system overall, then, you know, there are so many examples that we can learn from and that we can adopt from so many different countries. It's just, again, I do not like the phrase political will, but that is what we need. Yeah, we need political will and just determination to see it through. So we need to really look at it, or rather I look at it from two different perspectives. What can the executive branch do to improve the way in which they formulate policies? And then what can the legislative body do to improve the way in which they can review bills, as well as to provide better oversight when bills when laws are implemented, right? So with the executive branch, I already spoke about the importance of creating a culture and a practice of releasing white papers as well as green papers before big bills. I think that's crucial, and it's fairly easy to include that process within the existing system. Now, at the legislative branch level, obviously, to once again improve the rules and improve the conventions relating to giving access to members of the public into committees, right? And also allowing Malaysians the simple right to be able to put in a parliamentary petition, you know, putting forward a really clear process for that. Because everyone across the world, so many countries, yeah, members of the public are allowed to put in petitions, even online. And if they hit a certain threshold, then they are allowed to have the issues debated in parliament. So this is something that really Malaysians should be entitled to utilize as well. And just finally, apart from then just being able to involve stakeholders into the tabling and drafting of bills, it is the oversight process, right? So much more needs to be done on empowering parliament, specifically parliamentary committees, to conduct oversight work. And one of the ways in which we can do this is to include the requirement for reporting within various bills. So any tribunal or committee that has been set up under a bill to deliver a particular policy or program or activity or any government agency, there should be a reporting requirement back to Parliament so that Parliament can review the reports.
Maha, thanks for speaking with us today. That was Maha Balakrishnan, parliamentary consultant and researcher, weighing in on the drafting process for bills. Keep those thoughts coming. This is Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.